We will officially call to order the meeting of the Finance and Facilities Subcommittee for Wednesday, February 10th. Good to see everybody today. Looks like most everybody found us in our new room that we're using for today, so thank you. So the meeting will come to order. Members, please make sure that you set your cell phones on vibrate or silent, and also remember to turn on your microphone when you're answering roll call and when you vote, if we need that. And again, the new microphones are very good, and they can pick up even soft talking. So Cheryl, with that, if you will please call the roll so we can get started.
Chair Yarborough?
Here.
Representatives Beltran?
Here.
Benjamin?
Here.
Botana?
Here.
Bisotta Cabrera is excused. Caruso?
Here.
Taney?
Here.
Duran?
Here.
Fabricio?
Here.
Hinchovsky?
Here.
Joseph? Mello? Mooney?
Here.
Morales?
Present.
Persons Mullica? Sabatini? Tant?
Present.
And Williamson is excused. A quorum is present.
Thank you, Cheryl. Members, on our agenda today, we have the introduction of David Altmeyer, our insurance commissioner with the Office of Insurance Regulation, and then we'll have a few presentations that I will queue up for us in just a moment. But first, I'd like to introduce our insurance commissioner, Mr. David Altmeyer. And Commissioner Altmeyer has been with the Office of Insurance Regulation for over a decade and has served as insurance commissioner since 2016, following his appointment by the governor and cabinet, acting in their role as the Financial Services Commission. He is currently also serving as president of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And we're glad to have him with us today. Commissioner Altmeyer, you are recognized. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, committee. I know you've got a couple of important presentations this afternoon, so I won't take much of your time other than to say thank you for the opportunity to say hello and to provide an introduction. I've seen some familiar faces on your committee roles. Looking forward to working with all of you again. And for those of you that we haven't had the chance to work with yet, we're looking forward to working with you too. I know you'll have a lot of important issues to deal with this session. Some insurance related, some non-insurance related, but in either case, we are very happy and eager to serve as a resource for you all as you go through your important work. Call upon us anytime. And Mr. Chair, with that, I'll hand it back to you and thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner, and we like your radio style microphone that you have right there as well. That's pretty cool. So. Thank you. We appreciate you taking the time to introduce yourself to us today. And members, as the commissioner has said, feel free if you individually or if we need anything as a committee or a group, we can ask. But Commissioner Altmeyer and his staff, I've worked with them in years past before now, and they've been very responsive, and they know what they're doing and are happy to be a resource, as he's indicated to us, if we have any needs for us in our work or for our constituents as well. So, Commissioner, thanks for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, members, at this time, we will hear two presentations. One will be on hospital vertical integration and another on Florida's health insurance markets. And some of you may have heard and read about hospitals buying physician practices, ambulatory surgical centers, imaging centers, as well as other hospitals. And so today we're going to hear a presentation related to that and on the impact of this kind of market concentration, which will also include the effect on costs and access and the various types of actions governments can take to address anti-competitive activity. So to help us in that, first we have Tim Graney. He is a professor of law at the University of California, Hastings School of Law, and he is a preeminent scholar in health law and antitrust matters in healthcare. He will be discussing vertical integration and its impact on the healthcare market. Professor Graney, thanks for being with us today, and you're recognized to present before the committee.
Thank you very much. Really a pleasure to be here and to give you some of my thoughts on healthcare concentration in the marketplace. What I want to do is run through a large amount of material that I've packed into my slides that I've shared with the committee. I'm going to go quickly through some of these slides, and please do stop me if you want further details as I go along. And please feel free to contact me, have you or my staff contact me on any issues that you really want to, you want me to give more detail about. There certainly is a lot going on right now, and I'm going to run through a number of materials. Can you all see my slides? Are they visible to the committee?
Yes, sir. We're good. Thank you.
Good. Okay. So here's my lineup. That's an old lineup card filled out by Tony La Russa for the Cardinals. I'm going to begin with a brief talk about why consolidation is problematic from a cost and quality standpoint, and then talk about some of the antitrust remedies that have been brought out in litigation, and talk about the pros and cons of antitrust as a remedy to the problems of concentration. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the state legislation that's going on. I've given the committee two white papers we've done out here at UC Hastings College of Law that deal with specific analysis of all 50 states and what they're doing to deal with concentration via legislation. So I hope those things will be helpful. Let me beginning talking about concentration. There's a seminal article years ago by leading health economist, the late Uwe Reinhardt. And the title of the article was, "It's the Price is Stupid." And it was focused on showing that what really drives cost in America is high prices. It's not demographics, it's not utilization, and it's not technology. It is that we charge higher prices across the board, especially by providers. And this is, I think, a nifty chart that sort of illustrates that. If you take the United States as 100% across a whole range of, a wide range of procedures, hip replacements, bypass, colonoscopies, et cetera, and then you look what other countries do, you see a remarkable divergence from the United States 100% to really fractions of that, really half or less, charged by the UK, Switzerland, Holland, Australia, and so forth. Prices are just extremely high in the United States. And a number of economists really say it's the primary reason we spend so much is our high prices. The second piece of this analysis is that healthcare systems, multi-hospital systems, really lead the league in higher prices. And this chart, based on California data, shows higher prices by systems growing higher and faster than all other hospitals. What's the connection between high prices and concentration? Well, there's again a lot of economic data as to inpatient hospital prices being higher where concentration is higher. Same with physician services, and the premiums under the Affordable Care Act, the marketplaces, are higher where there's a lot of concentration. And the question occurs, well, how did we get here? How did we wind up with so much concentration in provider markets? And when I say concentration, I mean just too few competitors, markets with two, three competitors in the marketplace. The economic evidence is pretty strong that when that happens, prices go up and quality does not go up. And quality often goes down in many, according to many of the economic studies. How did we get here? Well, there's been under enforcement of antitrust merger law. We've had dry periods where not much was being done on the federal level. Importantly, the state attorneys general have become much more active on antitrust matters in healthcare. There have been erroneous decisions by the courts. The courts got it wrong in a number of cases, and that's been proven by retrospective studies. There are regulations that actually encourage mergers, payments that reward physician acquisitions by paying higher prices up based on the site of service, paying higher prices to doctors who are working for hospitals. And, you know, many providers misinterpreted the Affordable Care Act, and they say the ACA maybe do it, we're merging because of the integration. And the ACA does encourage integration, seamless delivery, but it does not encourage, is not intended to encourage monopolies. And finally, we see what I call a gold rush, which is really a headlong rush to acquire your rivals in the hospital market or to acquire as many physicians as you can. And the vertical issues are very important. I'm just going to go through these quickly, and I've listed a bunch of studies. I'd be delighted to talk to your staff or anybody who's interested. But the evidence about horizontal mergers, hospital-hospital or physician-physician, is very strong. Prices go up 20 to 44% in post-merger pricing by horizontal mergers of hospitals. Same is true with horizontal mergers among physician groups. What I think you're most interested in today is the vertical situation. What happens when hospitals acquire physician groups? Well, again, prices increase by an average of 14% according to one study. Independent studies of specific markets, cardiology, et cetera, see higher prices coming out of that. And importantly, we don't see evidence of quality improvement. Bigger is not necessarily better from a quality standpoint. And multi-specialty practices, interestingly, a very recent study by Lauren Baker out at Stanford shows that multi-specialty practices in concentrated markets, again, few competitors, wind up with higher prices for both the generalists and the specialists. The next frontier in healthcare might be looking at another set of mergers, which is cross-market mergers. And that's mergers in which hospitals acquire other hospitals, not in their geographic market, but because of their accumulated power, can bargain for higher prices from payers for their system. And they do that by what's called all or nothing contracting. They say to the payer, if you want our must-have hospital, we have a hospital that you have to have to be an effective insurance company, you have to get our other hospitals and pay a dear price for them. What does antitrust have to say about all of this? Well, I've spent my whole life, I began my career with the Justice Department. I spent 9 years there with the antitrust division as a litigator and later a supervisor of healthcare matters. And antitrust is very important here, but I'm calling it a paper tiger because it has only limited impact. First of all, as to mergers, if you're not policing mergers adequately, as the country did not do for a while, you have accumulated market concentration. As to conduct, what does antitrust have to say about high pricing? Actually, very little. It's okay to price to monopoly levels under the antitrust law, as long as you're not acquiring that power improperly or abusing it. So high pricing is not forbidden by the antitrust laws. And is antitrust a good deterrent? Well, the costs of litigation, the demanding legal standards, and the inadequate information that enforcers have make it something of a paper tiger. Here's just a quick snapshot that some of my friends put together to show how antitrust enforcement's proceeded. In the early years, going back to 86, there was sort of a mixed bag of cases. Greens were victories by the government. Reds were losses in litigated cases. And then there was a series of losses by the government for a period of over a number of years, almost 10 years. They lost 7 cases in a row, and a lot of concentration occurred. Then the FTC put in a study, a retroactive study of hospital mergers, and found out what changed the emphasis and provided economic analysis. And what happened was a long series of victories in federal court and in some state courts, stopping hospital mergers and some physician mergers. That came to an end just a few weeks ago when the district court in Pennsylvania found a merger between Thomas Jefferson Hospital and Albert Einstein Hospital. That's why I have the two pictures up there. Those two hospitals, it found those hospitals, that merger okay under antitrust law, based on the geographic market definition. And this is one of the hardest areas to litigate under antitrust law, because proving what the market is in a concentrated area like a Philadelphia and its suburbs is very difficult. We know all healthcare markets are local. We know people prefer to be in hospitals that are convenient and close to them, but drawing those lines is very difficult, and this case shows how difficult that is. What's going to happen going forward? Well, I think we can predict with some confidence that the new FTC chairperson, Commissioner Slaughter, who has said publicly there's a lot to bemoan about our healthcare markets, and I want to focus on hospital consolidation in particular, including especially acquisitions of physician practices. We should be as aggressive as possible in that area. There are other vertical mergers going on besides acquisitions of physician practices by hospitals. There's hospitals linking up with hospital insurers, and there was a big case in Florida some years ago involving a Health First, a major system with a lot of presence both in hospital, physician, and insurance markets. There's obviously the health insurer physician acquisitions too. Right now, today, United Health is the insurance company, is the biggest employer of doctors in the United States. And they've grown by acquisitions of physicians. Private equity is very active in acquiring physician practices in radiology, dermatology, and so forth. And there's also mergers pending right now involving tech platforms. So there's a lot going on. Some of these are very beneficial, some not. Let me just talk about whether we should worry about concentration or not. I've called this, I'm going to bust a few myths about concentration. I call this the sumo wrestler fallacy. Some people sort of instinctively believe, well, maybe it's a good thing to let there be mergers of big entities, big hospitals, big physicians, because they'll have to duke it out in the ring with big insurance companies. And the consumer will be better off as the two sumo wrestlers engage the big hospital or the big physician system with the big insurance company. It turns out the history and the economics of that don't support that hypothesis. Markets are really prone to negotiations that lead to anti-competitive problems. And there are a number of examples in the case law and in the literature. The wrestlers sometimes shake hands and they decide to take care of each other's market power. Another myth to bust is that consolidation equals integration. We like to think, and the Affordable Care Act and most policy experts think, we need more integration. We want hospitals and physicians to work together seamlessly. We want to have more coordination in the delivery system. But a number of economists have pointed out that it's not necessarily a good thing or necessary thing to have mergers that put them under one roof. And there are other arrangements through joint ventures and so forth that are possible. So consolidation doesn't always result in integration, nor is it necessary. So what should we do about all of this? That's, I think, the question that some of you are very interested in. Well, we certainly could use improved merger oversight, greater attention to the mergers that are ongoing and that are proposed. And I'm going to talk a little bit about legislative measures that can be done to improve competition, greater transparency, all payer claims databases, prohibiting price gag clauses. There are a number of legislative steps that can be taken to improve things. And there are also administrative solutions that I'll get to at the very end. There have been some major cases, by the way, against big systems. We brought one out here in California under our Attorney General Xavier Becerra, who is now Secretary of HHS. So it's going to be interesting to see what measures he brings to bear as the Secretary of the Health and Human Services. But that case was based on the market dominance of one system that was engaging in all or nothing contracting, and it's just recently settled. So what kind of legislative options are out there that are available? And let me put in a plug for the two white papers I gave the committee, and they're making available to members of the committee. We've done two white papers here at UC Hastings in coordination with the Petra Center at Berkeley. And we've tried to lay out a 50-state survey of what legislation is going on, active and proposed, to deal with concentration matters. And I'll show you a few of the charts that exemplify some of the results we found. But we've tried to take a look at what states have been doing, because states really are the laboratories for innovation and regulation. And they're also closer to the ground. They really know what's going on in their markets, and they're better equipped to deal with some of the problems that are specific to their markets. So there's some legislation that really tries, and I'll talk about each of these, that tries to deal with problems of contracting, most favored nations prohibitions, surprise billing laws, anti-steering, all or nothing contracts that dominant providers use to curb competition. There are other things we can do just to improve markets, like price transparency laws. And finally, there's the possibility that some states are looking at to actually cap prices, to put price regulation in effect that controls high prices by dominant entities. There are a number of things we can do. Going back to merger law, one of the white papers I gave you is sort of a model of some states that have had the most aggressive, I guess you could call it, or the most advanced forms of oversight of mergers in their state attorney general's offices and through their departments of health. So a really important part of this is prior notice to the attorney general when mergers are planned and proposed. Without prior notice of mergers, enforcement is really, really hobbled. If the attorney general can't stop, come in and stop the merger at the outset, and it's consummated, it's really hard to unwind a merger. The phrase we often use is unscrambling the egg is pretty hard. Some states have actually looked at prior approval, because most states have prior approval of mergers of nonprofit entities, nonprofit hospitals. Should they have prior approval power in across the board? I think attorneys general need input from their departments of health. Some legislative proposals have included enhancing the presumption of illegality and monitoring of consent decrees. Our white paper goes into all of this on those proposals. The other kind of legislative action that we look at in the other white paper is looking at the anti-competitive contracting. And again, a number of states have actually passed legislation or are considering legislation to actually ban certain kinds of contracting that is anti-competitive, including most favored nations clauses, anti-steering and anti-tiering clauses. And those clauses are contracts in which a dominant hospital, for example, or a dominant provider group says, we won't contract with you, the payers, the insurance companies, unless you promise not to put us in a higher, a disfavored category. In other words, where beneficiaries will have to pay more for their services. And those tiering and steering clauses are really important to insurers because it's one mechanism they have to control prices, to encourage their beneficiaries to choose the most cost-effective specialty group or hospital. And again, other contracting clauses are also under investigation. Actually, federal legislation that did not pass last term, a bipartisan bill, the Lower Healthcare Cost Act, would have provided put in prohibitions at the federal level. And just to give you a snapshot of some of the what's going on, and this is all in our white paper, many states have adopted adopted legislation that deals with these anti-competitive contracts. We see all the blue states have passed some form of prohibition on most favored nations clauses. Most favored nations clauses are clauses that say, you've got to give us the best possible price you give anyone else. Well, that's just flatly deterring competition. Other states have jumped into the fray restricting anti-tiering clauses. Again, those are clauses that say, don't put us in a disfavored tier, even though we're the highest cost to you, the insurer, and don't allow the consumer to have that choice of the more competitive contracting arrangements. Again, those things are just designed to interfere with the competition. There are bills pending that we've listed in our white paper. Indiana has one for pre-merger notification. Nevada has some going on, proposals about notification of certain kinds of mergers. The state of Washington has prohibitions on all or nothing contracting and tiering and gag clauses. So there are legislative remedies being looked at. And there is a range of choices. So, as I said, there are legislative prohibitions around the country being proposed or actually enacted. California has one notable bill that did not pass last term, but may pass this term. Litigation, again, is a possibility, but it's costly and time consuming. And I'll talk about some other options. Putting in the the hands of the state insurance department some powers to control the costs of high cost provider contracts. There are more aggressive forms like rate capping and certificates of public advantage that I'll talk about just very briefly. One interesting possibility is what's going on in Rhode Island. Rhode Island has something called the Affordability Law, and it empowers the State Department of Health Insurance when the state insurance commissioner is reviewing health plans proposed each year. He or she can approve or disapprove plans based on affordability. And that enables the insurance commissioner to look at criteria that might affect affordability, including high payments to dominant providers. And what this does is give some additional bargaining strength to the insurers who are trying to control the prices, the monopoly prices charged by dominant providers. They can say, well, the insurance commissioner has some power to oversee and disapprove our proposed rates for next year. So we can't pay you that high monopoly price you want to charge. Interestingly, Rhode Island law has also required increasing funding, increasing payments for primary care. So it's trying to readjust by insurance regulation the pricing dynamics that I think most policy experts agree has become distorted. And that changes the bargaining dynamic. There are some interesting articles that have studied all of this. And it could be adapted in some areas to empower insurance commissioners to reject plans with high contract prices. California has this bill which passed one house but didn't pass the other, the Senate. But it would do a number of these things. It would enhance merger review by the state attorney general. And this was proposed by Attorney General Becerra, now Secretary of HHS, and enhance the AG's review of mergers, but also empower the AG to challenge anti-competitive conduct when systems, and it defines systems as hospitals with three or more, controlling three or more hospitals with substantial market power, and gave the AG the benefit of a presumption that it was anti-competitive to engage in tying, exclusive dealing, or other contracts that have a substantial likelihood of raising prices. So again, there's some tinkering around the edges, enhancing the power of the AG to specifically deal in court with these kind of problems. There's another possibility out there that some states have engaged in, and I have to admit, I think this is a bad idea, but some states have said, let's empower a state agency to issue what's called certificates of public advantage. And these COPAs, they're called, C-O-P-A, these COPAs enable the state agency to approve hospital mergers, in some cases to absolute monopoly levels, but subject them to oversight, regulatory oversight, price caps, minimum charity care, minimum amount of Medicaid services, quality standards, and so forth. So it's very interesting that some states have opted for actual rate regulation, allowing mergers to monopoly in the hopes that they can control them by direct rate regulation. I have a lot of doubts about this, and the state of Texas has just approved a merger to monopoly in Abilene, Texas. And that statute actually gives the parties the opportunity to opt out of the arrangement. So there are a host of regulatory options out there. This is one I don't recommend, but it may be gaining some attraction. So just to give you a few takeaways, my bottom line is a reminder that high concentration at the physician level, at the hospital level, and certainly at the Hospital Physician United level results in higher provider prices. The high concentration gives them bargaining leverage. That leverage gets higher prices for them. Those higher prices in turn result in higher insurance premiums and those or copays and deductibles. So it trickles down ultimately to the consumer or the employer who's paying the insurance bill. What does that all lead to? Well, we know what high prices on insurance means. It means uninsurance. People can't afford the insurance, or underinsurance. They have to buy policies that have extremely high deductibles and make insurance really a sort of a shell game. Improved antitrust oversight is necessary. We need to stop mergers that result in this power, but it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. I've run through some of the legislative options, but once again, tackling the anti-competitive contracting is certainly one way of directly engaging the market power that exists and that is unlikely to be broken up. And rate caps and price setting is also an option, although that's an option I think that understandably most states are reluctant to engage in, and is really antithetical to our hope that competition can result in better prices, and we don't need to get government regulation in place. Again, the insurance department approach that I mentioned in Rhode Island is a very interesting one, and one in which we still rely on bargaining, but it's bargaining enhanced by the oversight of the insurance commissioner to at least put some constraint on the dominant pricing power of dominant systems. And again, we could do the same by enhancing the attorney general's authority. I'll just put in a final plug on what we do out here in California, at the University of California Hastings Law School. We have a website called the Source on Healthcare Price and Competition. It's sourceonhealthcare.org. And we have information about all sorts of things going on in the 50 states. We have a 50-state survey of legislation and competition policy in all 50 states. And we have another part of our website curates news and reports across the board in policy papers, newspaper accounts, and so forth. And we're trying to bring together law, policy, economics to join together in one place and talk about options. And it's a resource we hope for state policymakers, state attorneys general, and anyone interested in policy. And I've given some sources here. So again, I'd be delighted to certainly answer any questions you have now, and I'd be more than happy to engage myself and our team at Hastings to talk about legislative options. We're working with a number of states that are looking at some of these contracting practices and introducing bills. So we'd be happy to be involved at some level. So thank you for your attention, and happy to deal with any questions you may have.
Professor Graney, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a very informative presentation, and we appreciate that very much. And also for the mention of the website there at the end about Source on Healthcare, thank you for sharing that with us too. So at this time, committee members, are there questions for Professor Graney? Questions? Yes, Representative Duran, you're recognized.
Thank you, and it's great to have you here, Professor. I wanted to ask you, I read in a couple of articles over the summer regarding private equity. I saw it in some of your slides you had here on private equity and hedge funds kind of getting much more involved in the purchasing of practices and hospitals. Maybe you can comment a little bit on how you see that, and is that within some of the regulatory proposals you're saying there, does that touch on this issue in any way, shape, or form?
Professor, you recognize?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because there's no dispute but that private equity has engaged in purchasing physician practices or funding physician practices in a number of specialties, especially hospital-based emergency department care, pathology, anesthesiology, and so forth. And in some ways, that's not a bad thing. It gives physicians an option other than physician employment to maintain some independence. But it puts a lot of pressure on those physicians who do get acquired, because often the hedge fund acquisition is a short-term project for the hedge fund, and it wants to sell out after a few years. And at that point, things can become a little dicey for the physicians, and where they go from there, it may be in question. The one concern that I've raised is whether in some markets, the hedge fund actually controls so much of the specialty, let's just take emergency departments, that it can effectively raise price across the board to all the hospitals in the market. In other words, if it's one of only one or two entities providing those services in the market, it can essentially accumulate the market power that way. So there are a lot of questions about it. And frankly, there's not been certainly any antitrust litigation on that as far as I know. But it is an interesting dilemma for physicians some of whom are looking for a way to organize themselves to deal with the new world of contracting and value-based care. But at the same time, there are some risks down the road. So it certainly is something to keep an eye on.
Representative, you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, just one more. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Professor, one other area that I was interested in you commenting on is our last committee meeting, we were discussing the transparency bill that we've rolled out in the website, and some of the things that we've seen is some of the difficulty in actually getting that data into the system in a way that's helpful and useful. You know, I think that a part of that is like that there's no standard billing code and everyone has hundreds. Maybe you can comment a little bit on that issue and how that impacts price, affordability, et cetera.
Professor, we muted you just temporarily because we had some feedback, so you can go ahead and unmute yourself to answer. You're recognized.
Yeah, that certainly is one of the more difficult areas in terms of regulation. I think everybody agrees transparency is essential to better competition, both for the consumer to observe prices and for their employers to negotiate better prices. And at the consumer level, it's a little hard to effectuate. There have been some studies of what was done in New Hampshire, and maybe you guys have looked into the New Hampshire model, because New Hampshire, I think, was one of the leaders in rolling out price transparency models and putting it into effect. But there is the difficulty because consumers want to know not just what the cost of a service is, but how it affects their own personal deductibles and so forth. But to the extent you can put that in their hands, the whole idea of copays and deductibles is that the consumer can make an intelligent decision based on his or her net cost. And that includes what he or she is going to pay given their deductibles. So they need that information. But the other piece, the all-payer claims database, is another important possibility because that really helps the employer and the regulators to take a look at where the money is being spent, who is charging the higher prices, and how that's affecting competition. So I have some colleagues at Hastings who are quite expert on the payer claims databases and the transparency laws of the 50 states. So I can certainly put you in touch with them.
Okay. Thank you, Professor. Thank you, Representative Duran. Any additional questions, members? Okay. Representative Mooney, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Professor, for the presentation. A quick question. We talk about hospitals in general. The antitrust laws, how does that affect nonprofits? Because we're starting to see a proliferation of nonprofits who are accumulating smaller hospitals around their sort of territory. And how does that apply to them, or is there any difference whatsoever? Thank you.
Professor, you're recognized, and just make sure to unmute yourself again, please. Thank you.
Actually, the antitrust law is pretty clear on that the same standards apply to nonprofit charitable hospitals that apply to for-profit. And it's been litigated in a number of cases where it turns out that when the nonprofits acquire market power, they too raise price. And their mission is to put that excess pricing into charity care, et cetera. But the antitrust laws have been pretty clear that there's no exemption for nonprofit charitable hospital mergers. And there is a real concern, by the way, about the status of especially rural hospitals, safety net hospitals, which have suffered enormously, obviously, under the COVID crisis. There have been a number of studies that show that the relief that came out of the CARES Act was disproportionately high to large systems and inadequate to smaller hospitals. What does that mean? Well, that might mean that some of the rural safety net hospitals that were already struggling before the pandemic may be targets for acquisition going forward. And the jury's still out on just how much of that's going to occur. But I think a lot of people are predicting a wave of hospital acquisitions as the larger systems acquire them. Now, in some ways, that's a good thing. It might preserve the existence of a hospital that might otherwise disappear. But on the other hand, the risk of systems enhancing their market power, because now they can do the all or nothing contracting and the other things I talked about, are still present. So that is a real issue. But the bottom line in answer to your question is that hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, charitable hospitals will be subject to the same rules. One final point on that. The attorney general in every state, including Florida, has prior review authority, so that the charitable hospitals are under his or her supervision. And they do get advance notice of acquisitions. They can put in place requirements, not only as to rates, but as to the continued provision of charity care. They are the stewards of the nonprofit charitable hospitals. So you really rely on the attorney general to do the job of that shareholders do for for-profit hospitals. They're the only ones that have standing and have supervisory responsibility.
Representative Moody, did that answer your question? Yes, sir. Okay, thank you. Members, any additional questions? Okay, seeing none, Professor, thank you again. We appreciate your time today. Thank you for being with us and for your presentation.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure. And again, please have your staffs feel free to contact me and our team if we can be of any help.
That sounds good. Thank you for your offer. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, members, at this time, we will have Florida's Deputy Insurance Commissioner for Life and Health, Mr. John Riley. Florida's health insurance markets experienced some fluctuation in the years following the implementation of the Federal Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, including rate increases, greater market consolidation, and general fluctuation. Deputy Commissioner Riley is here to brief us on the current state of our health insurance markets. Commissioner Riley, can you hear us? And if so, you are recognized for your presentation.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I just want to say good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and distinguished committee members. I want to thank you for the opportunity that I had to discuss the state of our regulated health insurance markets in Florida. You guys all heard a lot about the power of competition and consumer choice in the previous presentation, and I think that will also be a major theme of my presentation today. So I want to start out. The mission of the OIR is to promote a stable and competitive insurance market for consumers. The OIR is focused around embracing our role in the new digital world and maximizing innovation, and doing so while streamlining processes to foster a robust insurance market in one of the largest, fastest growing, and most complex insurance markets in the world. The OIR strives to promote a healthy market for consumers. So what does a healthy market look like? Well, we believe a healthy market is a market where insurance products are available, reliable, and affordable. So what is our role as the Office of Insurance Regulation to accomplish those tasks? So the Life and Health Insurance Business Unit has three primary groups. So when we talk about reliability, what is one of the most important parts of reliability for an insurance product? It's making sure that the insurance company has the money to honor the promise to their consumer. So we have a financial oversight and solvency team that handles both licensing and solvency regulation for life and health insurers, HMOs, multiple employer welfare arrangements, TPAs, reinsurers, continuing care retirement communities, et cetera. Another important part of honoring that concept of reliability is our market conduct team. So we have a life and health market conduct team whose primary role is to conduct investigations and examinations of licensed entities that may have potentially violated statute or rule, or any unlicensed entities that should be licensed. So that is part of reinforcing that reliability concept. The next two we want to talk about is affordability and availability. So we have a team in our life and health product review team who handles policy form and rate reviews. The OIR reviews forms and premiums for most group and individual medical policies, limited medical such as hospital or cancer, dental, vision, long-term care, disability income, and Medicare supplement. However, we do not review the forms or the premiums for Medicaid, Medicare Advantage, or self-insured employer plans such as ERISA plans. And we also do not review the rates for any large group health policies. So that is kind of the primary way that we meet those three concepts. Moving on, we're going to move first into our small group insurance market. The small group market refers to insurance that is sold to businesses with 2 to 50 full-time employees. Under the ACA, these employees are exempt from the employer mandate, or these employers, sorry, are exempt from the employer mandate, meaning they are not required to offer insurance to their employees. Prior to the ACA, the small group market in Florida consisted of around 800,000 lives. Since the inception of the ACA, that market has kind of contracted down to around 500, to actually less than 500,000 lives, especially as small employers have dropped their coverage and their employees have purchased their plans through the individual exchange. This has certainly had a bit of an impact on the overall risk pool for this product. However, as you'll see in the next slide, it has not resulted in any kind of major rate impact. So here we have the small group market, the rate history. So this will basically take you through all of the rate actions we've had since the inception of the ACA. As you'll see, these rates have remained pretty stable. The trend is basically, these have kind of gone, medical trend is basically the concept that, you know, medical expenses, healthcare expenses tend to work in a similar way to inflation. And so you expect anywhere from a 5 to 8% medical trend factor that would be part of a healthy insurance market rate increase. And so through 2014, even down to 2020, you would see rate increases that are indicative of a fairly healthy competitive marketplace. One extra note is you'll see in 2021, we are actually below trend. And one of the reasons for that is increased competition between a couple of our major carriers. So this slide illustrates the 2021 small group rates across all of the companies in the market. You'll notice that there is a new form that is certainly something we're excited about. However, they are under the group of a larger group. So when we get to the number of carriers, et cetera, that's not something that would necessarily show up there. But as you can see, the rate review process for small group is fairly straightforward. There's not really any variance between the rate that was requested by industry and the rate that was approved. But as I noted before, that approved rate is below what you would expect normal medical trend to be. And that we believe is largely driven by competition. So here's a carrier map. We have traditionally done a number of years in the small group to kind of show the difference year over year with these carrier maps. However, this carrier map has not really changed. One thing we're really excited about is all of this dark green here that shows that there are more than 6+ individual carrier or small group market carriers in those environments. And even in these smaller rural counties, you'll see more than 4. Green is always good. And so as we get to the individual maps, you know, it's an important thing to note is that we're always looking for, you know, as many carriers as widespread a competition and availability as possible. And so this map really illustrates the health of a market that, despite having some issues with contracting enrollment, has remained a very healthy and competitive marketplace for our small employers. Moving on to the next slides, we'll show the small group market share over time. Due to the nature of the information, we're not able to provide market share information for plan years 2020 or 2021. However, it is evident that as the number of carriers has remained static, competition is not. So if you recall the pricing for 2021 being below the trend from the earlier slide, you can actually see the emergence of this competition and the companies that are involved in that as we proceed over the next couple slides. So here in 2017, you'll see Florida Blue is the strong market leader with almost half the market. Number two would be the United Health Group through their various entities at 20%. As we move to 2018, you'll see that this has gone down a little bit. However, United has gained 8% market share through additional pricing. As we move into 2019, you can see a pretty dramatic change in the way this market and the entire landscape of this market. And so this particular market share battle has actually kind of prompted this price pressure that's involved there. So that is the basic overview for the small group market. Now moving on to the individual market. This market refers to insurance sold to individuals under the age of 65 who are not enrolled in Medicaid or an employer plan and they're ACA compliant, meaning they include all the essential health benefits and are offered with no underwriting. That also means there's no pre-existing condition restrictions, et cetera. So this is obviously leaving out any short-term plans or other plans we're going to discuss later. Under the ACA, consumers can purchase an ACA policy through the exchange, which is what we call the on-exchange market, or from the carrier, which is directly from the carrier, which would be the off-exchange market. However, it's important to note that any individual looking to receive a premium subsidy would need to purchase it through the federally facilitated marketplace or on the exchange. Prior to the ACA, the individual market in Florida consisted of around 800,000 lives. Today, that individual market consists of more than 1.9 million covered lives. And as we get to the selection slide and a few slides, there is a reasonable chance, or there's a reasonable amount of information out there now to believe that that market is over 2 million individuals. So here in the chart, you'll see this is the individual ACA market rate history chart. This market has faced some tangible pricing uncertainty throughout its history. In the early days, companies were trying to find the right price point for a new uncertain risk pool. And so that really meant that prior to ACA, individual was focused primarily, you know, and heavily underwritten. So when a company underwrote an individual, they knew about the kind of risk they were taking on. Moving from 2013 to 2014, the main level of uncertainty was really, you know, what does it do to a risk pool when a company can no longer underwrite? What is an effective, what is the appropriate price for a risk pool that now includes all of those members? And so you'll see in the first few years, especially this 2014 rate, there was a ton of price adjustment related to that concept. This was followed in the later years by the loss of the risk corridor payments and then the defunding of the cost sharing ratio. However, it is important to note that since 2018, you can see the market and pricing has largely stabilized, which has allowed for expansion and competition in this marketplace. This slide illustrates the 2021 individual rates across companies. The OIR has approved rates for the plan year 2021, including a 2% COVID factor related to projected claims specific to COVID. We continue to work with companies to discuss the best way to account for the COVID experience for plan year 2020 on their claims experience. And as we begin to look at the rates for the plan year 2022, which will be filed in a few months. This slide actually tracks along really well with the rate increase history slide. As the stability and rate increases hit the market, you see that the number of carriers is tangibly impacted. The market experienced a combination of carrier withdrawal and consolidation throughout this period. The number of carriers in the market, however, does not always necessarily mean greater consumer choice. And so I want you guys to keep note of this 2017, the 14 number, because it's something that it seems like there's a ton of competition and spread and consumer choice in the market for 2017. However, as we look in the map for 2017, you'll see a lot of this dark red. So this dark red indicates that there's a low number of carriers, particularly this dark red, which is there's only a single carrier available to the consumers in that marketplace. Now, while 2017 had 14 carriers who made filings on the individual marketplace, you'll see that those were primarily concentrated in a few large enrollment areas, and that much of the state was left with very little consumer choice. As we move on to 2018, you'll see, remember that large rate increase for plan year 2018 that had an impact on the number of carriers. And as a result, you'll see we've basically lost all of our green, which is any county with over four carriers. And now we've got a few with three, but we're still kind of tangibly dealing with this large impact here. Moving into 2019, we mentioned that rates more or less have stabilized back to plan year 2018. And so now in plan year 2019, you'll see the green begins to come back. These three carrier counties have spread. And then we even have a little more spread of two carrier counties into some rural counties such as Putnam and Alachua. From 2019 to 2020, we had continued expansion in the marketplace, and we even had a couple of new carriers. So now we've gone from a couple of green counties now to a number of counties, and it's spread throughout a large portion of the state. However, in 2020, we were still dealing with more than 30 single carrier counties. And so the main transition here, as you see when we go to plan year 2021, and these are the plans that are currently, well, that were just part of the open enrollment, we are down from more than 30 carriers last year, single carrier counties, to three. Going back to 2017, we had 47 single carrier counties. And so in that period of time and this market stabilization, we've now moved down to three. You'll see these are all two carriers, and even the spread of three carriers, four carriers, and six carrier counties has greatly increased over this time period. The market share information has been pretty stable. However, you will see a trend. Here we are in 2017. Florida Blue has more than 64% of the market. And remember, we had the large rate increases that hit 2018. We had a few carriers leave. And so that market share actually increased. You do see Celtic here has grown year over year going back to 2017. And so now they've taken a pretty prominent position as the number two carrier in the market for 2018. Moving into 2019, you see that trend continue with Celtic growing, Florida Blue having a slight dip in market share, but still a pretty commanding presence, but also some additional carriers such as Oscar that entered the market in that year. Moving to the next slide, you'll see the exchange selection numbers. So this slide basically represents the number of plan selection that members made on the federally facilitated exchange. I want to note that the 2021 numbers that you see down at the bottom are subject to change because there is a special enrollment period that has been opened for the period of February 15th through May 15th. So there is a very real chance that this 2.12 million number could increase over the next few months. As with the rate increase slide, the market stability achieved a few years ago has continued to pay dividends in the number of plan selections made on healthcare.gov over the last few years. This was reversing a period of fairly relative stagnation. These selections, it's important to note, these selections do not always result in enrollment, but they do provide a really good indication of the number of consumers who could be a part of this marketplace. So that concludes our discussion on the individual marketplace. Now we're going to move into a discussion from House Bill 997 and specifically two plans that were a part of that health bill, of that bill. Number one, we're going to discuss the association health plans, and number two, the short-term plans. So we spent a lot of time discussing the power of competition and consumer choice in the market. Both of these products were changes that we are discussing were designed to provide additional options for consumers looking to obtain coverage that fits their budgets and their needs. So one of these was an expansion to the existing definition of an eligible association health plan. The second was a change to the term length and renewability available for short-term health plans. House Bill 997 modified existing state statutes to provide additional flexibility for small business owners looking to join together and access cheaper large group rates. This bill also extended the duration of short-term plans to a term of less than 12 months and a renewability of less than 36 months, and added a mandatory disclosure requirement to make it clear to consumers that this product was not intended to be compliant with ACA rules or regulations. Those rules and regulations would include no pre-existing conditions, as well as coverage of all of the essential health benefits that are required by ACA plans. There are a few action items that the office took related to the bill. Some of these included rule changes, as well as some legal analysis based on the definition of association health plans, and even training for our staff that does contract review for the changes made to the short-term health plans. But I believe the number one and the primary takeaway is that there is both current activity and also continued interest from industry in these particular products in the market. Florida currently has two licensed MIWAS association health plans and one in the licensing process. In addition, there are three carriers offering short-term limited duration plans, and there is one also currently in the licensing process. So that concludes my presentation today. Like I said before, I really appreciate the time and the opportunity to provide this update and hopefully serve as a resource for the legislature. And now I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Commissioner, thank you for your presentation. We appreciate that. It was the slides were great, easy to understand. We appreciate your time with us today and for giving us that presentation. So thank you. Members, we're now open for questions. Questions for Commissioner Riley. Rep. Duran, saw your hand first, and then Ranking Member Joseph. Go ahead, Rep. Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Riley, thank you for being here and for your presentation. Just really quick, on that last slide, you had mentioned the association health plan and then the short-term health plans. Do we know how many, like what the coverage is, like how many lives are covered under or have purchased short-term health plans so far?
You're recognized.
Thank you, sir. I don't have it off the top. I can pull that together. I actually have the team working on it today, and we're still pulling it because the information, the report that we have to pull that information from is a little dated. And so I think we'll have some updated information on that really soon.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Duran. Ranking Member Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have three questions tied to the same subject.
Sure, that's
okay. So, Mr. Commissioner, you showed us a couple of charts about the rate trends, and I had a couple, going back to the one for small groups, you said that a healthy range was somewhere between 5% and 8%, but in 2014, it was at 12%. You told us about the low end at 3%, and that was due to increased competition. What's the basis for the 12.3%?
You recognize.
So, I think that was in the same transition year, you would have seen a pretty large impact from people leaving the small group market into the individual market. That was the first year that ACA came in. And so that year, that 12% probably reflects an amount of uncertainty in the market or in this particular market, as well as in the individual market. Because anytime you have uncertainty or instability, that does tend to have some level of rate impact. And as I mentioned when I covered this slide before, I would also kind of highlight that there would be some kind of impact to the risk pool associated with that. And I think that kind of factors into that risk as well.
Okay, similarly, so that's with the small group market. With the individual market, I saw the same jump for 2014, but then I saw one in 2018. What was the basis for the 2018?
You recognized.
Correct. So in 2018, those rates were filed without the cost-sharing ratio consideration. And so there was a plan, there was a funding mechanism as a part of the ACA that was up until 2018 part of subsidizing those rates called CSRs or cost sharing ratios.
Okay.
Those were essentially a benefit in which the government paid plans for these very special silver plans, these enhanced silver plans that go up to 94% actuarial value. And so those CSRs were meant to kind of defray the cost of those really high benefit plans. When a court case kind of undid that cost sharing ratio mechanism, the silver plans now had to rate based on the actual cost of the plan without that cost sharing ratio in it. And so that, as you'll see with the little double asterisks down there, that loaded an additional, a large additional rate into this, that particular tier, which drove the overall rate.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, member. Did you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do. So I would be curious to know, I'm not familiar with that particular case that you're referring to. You can, if you wouldn't mind sharing that either to my office or through the chair, I'd be curious to know what happened there. And then last, just to kind of tie it all together, I guess I'm trying to get a gauge of, from the charts, it seems like the rate increase seems to correspond to a decrease in consumer choice, particularly in options in different markets. How does that work? And if there are any contributing if there are any other contributing factors?
You're recognized.
So I would say the increased rates, and we can kind of go here. As you see, you know, that there is a fairly kind of tangible impact there on the number of carriers. That track the uncertainty that's reflected in those larger rates. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of uncertainty going into that 2014 plan year where you see that 35% rate increase. And so I would say I guess I'm flipping a lot here. Going into this map, you really see that price pressure, that uncertainty, that instability, I think, is kind of the thing to focus on. Anytime there's instability in a market, there's hesitancy for expansion. Mm-hmm. And so that's really where you see the impact of these large rate increases, and they're related to instability. And that kind of results in a situation where you don't have expansion, you don't have additional plans, you don't have additional carriers, et cetera. Was that clear? Could I restate that a little better for you?
Ranking member, go ahead.
Last follow-up to kind of tie it in, what should be our takeaway on the committee in terms of things that we can do or policies that we should consider that encourage market competition, particularly more greens than reds, in terms of accessibility for consumers, is really what I'm trying to get a gauge. I'm trying to decipher what I should be taking away from these charts.
Commissioner, you recognize?
So I think, sorry, sir. I think my main takeaway would be that the market has largely stabilized. So my encouragement would be allow the market to remain stable, to keep this, to keep the regulatory structure that we have in place certainly is consistent with that.
Okay, thank you, Ranking Member. And Commissioner, if you could just make sure per that information request from the Ranking Member, if you could follow up with her office and provide that, we would appreciate it.
Absolutely. I will make sure we get on it.
Okay, thank you. Vice Chair Caruso, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair Yarbrough. Deputy Commissioner Riley, appreciate your presentation today. It's very informative. You showed us slides outlining the stabilization of insurance carriers in the individual market with additional carriers coming into the various counties, which I would imagine is due to profit incentives. But how do you explain this stabilization at a time when, according to Professor Greeny earlier today, cost of the healthcare is escalating vertically?
You're recognized.
I would say that's kind of a multi-part question. The best takeaway would be, I'll stay kind of focused on the ACA marketplace specifically, but this is a market from an enrollment perspective that has continued to grow, that the carriers who are engaged in that marketplace, have been successful, that has caused, additional expansion for those carriers. A lot of it kind of, as you see, we talked a lot about how the rates going into ACA, companies were trying to find the right level, right? So what is the rate level that fits a marketplace that's not underwritten? And so a lot of the instability that went into this kind of drove towards that concept. So that when carriers have now found a level that is appropriate for the risk involved, I think that's created a lot of the stabilization. Now, I do think it's fair to note that there are potential concerns from a unit cost perspective. Based on the information we have right here, it doesn't seem like that is impacting the competitive landscape of the ACA marketplace. However, there is certainly the potential with this vertical integration that it could have some impact in the future.
Vice Chair, that answer your question? You have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a follow-up.
Go ahead.
I'm working on it. I just found your chart on rate history, and yes. It doesn't seem, it does not seem to agree to the rate history of medical healthcare cost. I'm looking at 18, 8.2%, 19, 6.0%, 20, 7.4%, 21, 3.4%. But
at a time,
I'm sorry?
This is a small group, right? Sorry.
That's small group, yes. And at a time when healthcare costs, as I said, were escalating vertically.
You recognize, Commissioner.
So I think medical trend is the concept that kind of goes hand in hand with that concept, right? When we say it's what drives, it's essentially a medical cost inflation. That is part of this concept, is that, you know, the cost for contracting with hospitals, for contracting with physician groups, goes up at a certain level each year. And that really is, you know, how that correlates into the rates. And so I would say to a degree that they're actually, you know, that is the kind of phenomenon that would drive those rate increases. And so in a world where, you know, those costs don't increase and the market is stable and competitive, you know, a medical trend would certainly be a lot lower than 5 to 8%.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Riley.
Thank you. Representative Benjamin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I'm listening to everything that's being said from the first presenter to your presentation to the questions from my colleagues. I'm still left with the question of, I understand that we may be doing good in Florida, but like any good shareholder, the thought to me comes, how can we still do better? How can we get more?
Commissioner, you recognize.
So would the question be from an enrollment perspective?
From an enrollment.
Representative, go ahead.
From an enrollment perspective and from a competitive perspective, which drives down cost.
Commissioner, you recognize.
Thank you, sir. I would say, how do we continue to improve? Would, you know, continue to work to bring in new carriers into the marketplace, to continue to work with existing carriers to expand further. I think that's certainly one component. Another component obviously has to do with, you know, awareness. If there's awareness in the public for these products, the degree to which there's awareness in any given county or community, I think that's certainly, you know, another driver there.
Follow up? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
And so with that being said, what's the agency's plan in making these things happen?
Commissioner, you're recognized.
So for me personally, my goal is to continue to engage industry on that expansion and new carrier component. And that includes, you know, outreach, calling, you know, seeing, you know, working on strategic plans with industry to see, you know, what their goals are and integrating that into the goals that we have for that marketplace.
Representative, good. Representative, thank you. Okay. Representative Tant, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you. I have two questions, and I'll make them brief. The first question, well, it's really related to the association / short-term plan, since this is new to me. So this is my freshman not knowing this issue. So in terms of the association health plans, I see from the definition you provided that it is for a group of individuals coming together, ensuring at least 15 members. Do these also comply with the small group insurance plans, or are they larger than the 1 to 50 group?
You're recognized.
So, thank you, sir. The goal here would be for a group, when they say multiple employer welfare arrangements, the main goal of these association health plans is to create a number of different small businesses that have some relationship to come together and then move into a market that's more like a large group market, which is your 50 plus.
Gotcha.
Now, where they fall in the exact number of employees, the main goal is to create a larger risk pool, which creates access to cheaper premiums, because the risk is more certain that the more members you have within a risk pool.
So, I mean, I think this.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a great idea. Question is, to follow up on Representative Duran's question, how many lives are covered, but how many different groups are in there? Do you have any information on that?
Commissioner, you recognize?
Do you mean how many individual employers make up these?
Yeah, like just like who comes together? Like who comes together for this? You know, some examples of that.
So you would normally see kind of just a generic example would be, you know, any group that has kind of a trade association relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could be Woodworkers of America. It could be, you know,
that makes sense.
You know, kind of anyone with that kind of relationship. So that you have a number of small groups that make that up, but they can come together to create this product.
My last question.
Hello, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the short-term plans, what is the genesis of that, and what happens after the 36-month or shorter to those employees? Is the idea to get them into a long-term plan? What's the reason? I'm just wondering what the rationale is and what happens to these people.
Commissioner, you're recognized.
Thank you, sir. The genesis of the plans were really plans that initially were kind of, I don't want to call them gap plans, but these short-term plans were kind of for people to sit in between other coverages. Many of the changes we made have made them a more viable, I don't want to call it long-term, because they have, that 36 month limit period, but they're meant to function more as an actual standalone insurance, you know, health insurance product. What happens after the 36 months, the individual would certainly have to enroll into another policy. So the term limit of that policy would end, and they would certainly have the option to move into another one.
Thank you.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representatives, any additional questions for Mr. Riley? Okay, seeing none. Commissioner, thank you for being with us today again. We appreciate the presentation.
It was an honor. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, sir. Members, this concludes our committee agenda today. I very much appreciate your attention and the questions and interaction on the presentations. So seeing no further business before our committee, Representative Benjamin, as he so graciously did last time, moves again that we rise. So without objection, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.